welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali from Paid Content. How are you doing, Rafat?
I'm good, Mark. How are you?
I'm great. I have a new addition to my family. It's not a kid, but it's an iPad 2.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. You got to take care of it now. Your whole life has changed.
Yeah, definitely. The funny thing about it was that, you know, of course, it's very difficult to find one. It's like you have to go onto the black market or Craigslist or something to find one. And there was a Best Buy in San Francisco that had them. And when I got there to get one, they happened to have 64 iPad 2s, but they were all the most expensive Verizon one for $829. Wow. That's all they had.
This is with that,
what a coincidence.
Yeah, and this is with the 3G network and everything.
Right, exactly. There are no Wi-Fi iPad 2s, and I'm seeing that as a kind of a pattern, that it's a lot easier to find the most expensive ones than the cheaper ones. Immediately, my 8-year-old son took it and decided that it's the best gaming platform around, and uploaded a bunch of games onto it. I've been checking out a lot of the aggregation apps like Flipboard and the ones we talked about before, NewsMe.
Right.
And
Zeit.
I really do like them. I just, you know, I feel like they're really excellent at helping wade through things, but they're almost they don't feel like they're smart enough. And you know, I think they still give me too much to look at.
Yeah, and news.me, which is trying to, I guess, trying to come up with solutions to that problem, I don't know yet. I mean, I've used it enough, but I still don't feel like they're getting what I want.
Yeah, I feel like they're all trying to get this smart, you know, there's this idea of the smart agent or the valet or someone who's going to basically bring us the stories that we're going to care about the most and kind of read our minds. And I just feel like there's still a little bit too much noise in those channels. It's hard. It looks really pretty, especially Flipboard looks great. You know, but it still doesn't quite filter things as good as it could.
Yeah, and also, I mean, our sort of news consumption pattern a lot is based on Twitter and Facebook as well. And I've seen an interesting pattern where more directed choices that we make are through Twitter because we're following certain kind of people primarily for work or semi-work related reasons. On Facebook, you're trying to follow your friends, which there's an overlap, but it sort of is more serendipitous than Twitter. So you seem to get a more broader range of articles on Facebook, and some of them are, and by definition, most of them are longer reads than just the news that we get on Twitter. So a mix of both covers me pretty well, I have to say, compared to the apps that you and I are using. It seems like it, but maybe there's some way to bring it all together, which I guess is what Flipboard is trying to do.
Yeah, how is your iPad? I'm curious how you use your iPad versus your laptops, because that's been the big thing for me. I feel like an iPad still feels like more of a home device and maybe something for a big trip, but maybe not something I would take to a cafe or out to, like, on a short trip.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it is. I've been using it. Primarily to catch up on Twitter in the morning. So I catch up on my email and Twitter and Facebook on the iPad the first thing. I don't want to go and sit at the laptop because it feels like I'm sitting at work. So instead of, even though it's in the same room, I'm working from home, part-time at least working from home. But the first thing in the day I don't want to do is go and sit at the laptop. I want to get my cup of tea and actually sort of relax and read it, and that's where I think iPad is probably the first use of the day, at least for me. It'd be interesting to see how your schedule develops around it.
Yeah, I mean, I was using Kindle to read the San Francisco Chronicle. I had a subscription with Kindle, but now on iPad just blows away reading on everything else. I was using my iPhone. To look at the New York Times, and I was using my Kindle to look at the Chronicle, and you know, it feels like for newspaper and magazine reading, the iPad's just going to win over both of those devices for sure.
Yeah, I mean, certainly short to medium form reading is what iPad is made for.
For this episode of Media Twits, we're going to be talking about the first topic is, do news organizations own the social media accounts of their reporters and people who work for them? You know, who owns those followers? If you're a reporter and you build up a lot of followers, do you own them or do news organizations own them? And then we're going to have a guest, John Taman, who's the CEO of Byliner, a new startup that is focusing on long-form journalism, really serious long-form journalism, and trying to sell it by the piece and also create kind of a portal for long-form journalism. He'll be on. And then finally, we'll get back to Apple and its tracking, the iPhones and iPads tracking us. Steve Jobs and some executives respond to questions about it, say it's all a big misunderstanding, and we'll look at the MediaShift poll results and how people feel about Apple tracking them. First, let's start with news organizations, and they're both, you know, whether they own the social media accounts and followers for their reporters and staffers, and also what their social media policies are and how that's been changing. We've seen some pretty pretty strict policies come and go over the years, and there's a couple new ones that just came out, one from the Toronto Star and one from Bloomberg that seem very restrictive. So we'll talk about those as well. But first, let's talk a little bit about this idea of who owns the social media accounts. It came up, there was a panel discussion at Facebook headquarters for journalists and kind of a combination of journalists and social media people. Facebook has been really pushing, you know, reaching out to journalists more, and this was one of their events. Catherine Zaleski, who's the head of digital news products at the Washington Post, said she thinks a news organization might actually own a staff journalist's social media followers, depending on contractual agreements. But that sounds a little strange. What do you think about this idea that, you know, I mean, I guess the first question is, what do you think? I mean, who really does own the followers or own the social media accounts? If you're a reporter, you obviously gain followers because you're at a CNN or you're at Washington Post or you're at one of these big outlets, but do you deserve those followers for yourself? Like, how much should go to you and how much should be the organizations?
Well, I mean, I don't think any of it will stand any court of law about followers. It doesn't matter what the journalist's contract is with the employee. It probably matters what the user's contract is with Twitter or Facebook.
Right.
And I think that probably will be the paramount part of it. And can that be owned by a third party besides Facebook and Twitter or the user itself? I highly doubt that it would stand in any court of law that way.
Now, that's now she's saying that they might put that in a contract for someone. So in other words, if you went and got a job at the Washington Post, you might actually have to sign a contract saying, you know, for whatever Twitter account you set up while you're employed here, you know, we get to keep those followers. I mean, but you think that language wouldn't hold up?
If it's certainly something that a company uses for their own usage, for instance, it's a special event Twitter feed, or it's a Twitter feed related to the company that an employee populates. Of course, some human being has to populate it, and that account gets followers as a result. Yes, of course, that's the company's property, so to speak. But if it's a user that opens, I mean, there could be a case made for like the example that I think you gave before was the Rick Sanchez CNN thing.
Right. His handle was Rick Sanchez CNN. And when he got fired, and he had a pretty large following, I mean, he really used
mm-hmm.
Twitter a lot
yeah.
for, you know, whatever you think about him as a person or a reporter or an anchor. He used it a lot. He was, you know, he made it a big part of what he was doing. And so he had a huge following. And I think he was able to pretty easily change it to just Rick Sanchez and keep his followers.
Yeah, I mean that's they probably email Twitter people and they did on the back end. I did not see any reports about CNN objecting to it. It'd be foolish for CNN to do it. It would be foolish for any media company to do it. Imagine them out of sort of social media PR disaster. I don't know if it's going to be. I mean, disaster seems to be a strong word, but some subset of it, it would be if they try and sort of do that. So if only for that, it would be foolish for them to do that. And certainly, if I mean, it's almost I'm almost reminded of like divorce laws and what you bring in before a marriage, and then during a divorce, what gets split which way. So it's
Yeah,
almost
we're
that.
both experts on that.
We're both experts on that, in actually the same state, I think. So I think that it reminds me a little bit of that.
Right. So what you're saying is, if you know, I built up my own following on Twitter, then I went to work for a company, and then I built it up some more. What is it that I gained while I was in that marriage, with the news organization? So it gets very tricky. I don't. It doesn't seem like it's very clear what should happen. I mean, we all think as journalists that, we deserved it. We were the ones running that feed. We should be able to keep it. But maybe the news organization does have an argument that, we were part of the reason why you became so popular or why you had such a following, right?
Yeah, and it could be where, and I know this is kind of complex, again, taking the divorce analogy slightly further, where the company, if it transitions the Twitter feed into something else that they have, they get to keep those followers, as well as the new account that the user has gets to keep, but the followers then are given an option of choosing which one. I don't know. This sounds too complex. But I'm sure there's an easier way to do it.
And what about this idea that, Bloomberg has come out and said, do not, we should not share work in progress or use social media as a vehicle for breaking news. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, what do you
Bloomberg.
think first?
Well, I think this idea that you're going to save the news. I mean, as a blogger, even, I mean, even at paid content, I'm sure, do you really want to put news onto Twitter when you don't have a link to something, like what do you get?
Yeah.
What do you get out of put breaking news on Twitter or on Facebook? If I mean, as a news organization, you want to get traffic to your site or to your story, so you usually want to have something up before you break it. But I think the sharing the work in progress is different because it might not be a big breaking news story, but you might just be working on a feature, and why not ask people for the, sources or information as you're working on it?
Yeah, and not all breaking news, as you can see, as you know well, is equal. There's a breaking news that's happening that everybody's covering. And there you can see the role of Twitter, where you're breaking stuff on Twitter as it happens. Let's say it's a shooting, let's say it's a some weather related event or something else happening. Then you're breaking stuff on Twitter. If you're working on an exclusive enterprise reported piece that is genuinely hot and you don't want anybody else to get on it, then you don't want to let the process on, of course. So I think what Bloomberg tried to mean, I think that's what they meant, because they play in breaking exclusive stuff that moves the market. That's their MO. And so I think that's what they mean. I hope that they have shades of gray in there instead of just a blanket policy. But knowing Bloomberg, is probably a blanket policy.
Yeah, I think these blank that's the big problem is these blanket policies that end up, probably written somewhat by lawyers that are saying things like, you should have no opinion about what the stories are that you're working on, or stories that, this news organization is working on. And you shouldn't respond to readers and what they're saying about your story, or you shouldn't go into comments and respond to them. And it gets way too heavy-handed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bloomberg, which has their reasons to have their policies, but they've had very strict stuff you can write, the words you can use. So, I mean, it seems like an extension of their anal retentive reason for being anyway. I don't know if that's so. Is that a word we can use on the podcast?
Yes, sure. I think it's okay.
It's okay. Okay. All right. So it's in keeping with their general nature. So I'm not hugely surprised.
Okay, let's bring in John Taman, CEO of Byliner. So John Taman is an award-winning editor and writer, author of the 2006 bestseller The Colony. He's an editor at Techland, Time Magazine's technology blog, and has worked at a wide range of magazines, including Outside, Men's Health, Business 2.0, which we miss, Men's Journal, and Life Magazine. He's also immersed himself in the world of digital startups. In 2008, he launched Motormouths.com, kind of like a Rotten Tomatoes for car reviews. And in 2009, he started developing Byliner.com, which combines his love of writing with development of technology. And really, the idea behind Byliner, you can explain it to us even more, but what we think it is that it's really a celebration of long-form journalism and a way to kind of come up with something that's in between magazine journalism and a book, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it, Mark. There's two components to it. There's a publishing arm of it, and we publish what we call Byliner Originals, and those are original pieces that we commission, great stories we try and put in the hands of great writers, and they are designed to be published at links that allow them to be read in one sitting, so 2 hours or less. And we released the first one of those last Monday. It's a piece by Jon Krakauer, who your listeners and/or readers might know from Into Thin Air and Into the Wild. And it's a story that's titled Three Cups of Deceit, and it's an investigation into the life and the world of Greg Mortensen.
Right, yeah, I read that one, and it's an amazing story. I mean, obviously got a ton of play. I saw that you had 70,000 downloads, so and you gave that away for 3 days free, right?
We did. That's one of the things that John specifically wanted to do. The story involved, some improprieties and some questions about a charity that a lot of people know and kids give pennies to peace for and everything else. So he felt it was important that the first. That this story be widely available as easily as possible to a giant audience of readers so that anybody who might be considering giving to this charity or has given in the past would have all the information they need. So we put it up as a downloadable PDF for the first 72 hours. And as you mentioned, more than 70,000 readers downloaded a copy. What's interesting, Mark, is it then moved to the Amazon Kindle Single Store, where it's priced at $2.99. Within 6 hours of it hitting the store, it went to number one, and it's been at number one ever since. And so, people are clamoring to read this thing, and we think it's a great development for stories that are told at this sort of length in primarily digital form.
And can you tell us this? Do you have any early sales numbers on what you've done as far as paid sales?
We do. Now, Amazon doesn't particularly like its publishing partners to reveal the specific numbers. I can just tell you that it would be on a conventional bestseller list already, given the numbers that they've gotten. It's, as I mentioned, it's been number one at Amazon for the last 5 days. Amazon, Byliner, and John are all extremely happy with how readers have been reacting to it and buying it.
So, John, this is Rafat. So you haven't technically launched the site yet. This was, I guess, a test case for it.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Rafat. The full site, Byliner.com, launches in a few weeks, in the middle of May. We happened to release this one early because it was timed to a 60 Minutes piece that was also covering this story and that John contributed to a little bit. And we, in fact, are releasing the second Byliner original next week on Tuesday. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. But the full site itself is actually the second component of our company. And it was something that I started developing and creating primarily as a distribution and a discovery channel for these kinds of stories that we wanted to tell. I had been thinking about and working on Byliner for almost a couple of years, well before the iPad came out and the Kindle came out and the other tablets that everybody knows are out. And so although I knew instinctively that stories by great writers told at this length would be well received, both by the authors that are doing them and also by the readers who might be wanting to sit down in a single sitting and enjoy them, the mechanisms for getting those titles in front of readers didn't really exist. So what we had to do was create what's essentially a platform, a metaphor that some people who've seen the beta site and worked in it is something not unlike Pandora. A system that lets readers discover new writers and their work. I'll do it pretty simple. The system is designed to help a user find something good to read. And that might be a new article, a classic article, or an article by a writer that they haven't yet discovered. It's also a way to discover a traditional book and, you know, increasingly as we publish more of them, a Byliner original. So the basic idea is to give a reader the opportunity to do deeper discovery or cross-discovery related to an article or a writer, in a way that simply not possible online. And we do that by aggregating and structuring the very best feature journalism pieces that have been published, you know, in the last 100 years, and organizing them so that somebody who might be a fan of John Krakauer's can not only, you know, jump online and see that here's this new Byliner original that he published, but they've also got easy access to his conventional books and also very simple and logical access to any piece that he's ever written that might be available online.
Yeah, it seems difficult to, so you're coming at it in two ways, because you're a publisher yourself and then you're also aggregating other people's works, right?
Yeah, I don't know if it's difficult or not. It seemed entirely logical to me. If I am a fan of John Krakauer or Mary Roach or Susan Orlean or Caitlin Flanagan or Sebastian Younger, what doesn't exist right now is a place that I can easily find any of their work, all of their work. Some of these authors might have a blog. They might have a personal page. But keeping a curated, comprehensive, clean directory of their feature journalism alongside their books and any other original work they do is a fairly complicated process. It's something that a lot of writers don't even simply want to deal with. And as a reader, I lack the ability to have what, you know, people in your community who might be developers would, you know, the equivalent of their GitHub page or their portfolio page or their LinkedIn page. And at its simplest level, what Byliner does is it allows someone to go and see everything that their favorite writer might have that's available to read. It enables them to come from somebody with a casual knowledge of a writer's work to becoming a fan simply by diving deeper into their work.
It seems like some of the words that you're using, John, like discovery and long form and some of the other phrases that you've used, it seems a little counterintuitive for the web, but it seems perfect for something like an iPad, which Mark, by the way, is a new owner of just the last few days.
Congratulations, Mark.
Thank you.
So, what I mean, it seems like it's experience more conducive to that. Have you thought of sort of, and even the payment mechanism just seems to be a lot more easier through the iPad. Have you thought of that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there are a couple of things. We tend to prefer the term feature articles. I think the phrase, the term long form or long read is slightly off-putting. It doesn't invite me in to try and read a great story. But having access to great feature work by an author that allows me to get a sense of the type of writing they do, the types of things they're interested in, and then allow me to sort of move up the chain so that I might be able to read one of their longer Byline original pieces, which tend to fall between 10,000 to 35,000 words, and then go even further and get access to their books, seems entirely logical to me.
So tell us, you said something's coming up next Tuesday. What's on tap?
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and it sort of underscores the sorts of things that we want to do. What we did was we sent William Volman, the National Book Award winner, to Japan, to the nuclear evacuation zone for 2 weeks, and he's writing about life within that zone. He's there with a Geiger counter, a decimeter. He's visiting the families, the people who have been shunted aside, and really writing about the tsunami and the earthquake and the nuclear crisis. He's got a 20,000 word story that is unbelievably great, that is going to get in front of readers on Tuesday and be what we hope is the early and yet definitive work on what is occurring there right now.
Wow, that's amazing. And would you consider like running, when you have someone like that in a place that's so topical, would you consider, you know, photos, video, audio, other multimedia elements with the story?
Two parts to that answer, Mark. There will be a few photos in the original, in the Byliner original. Well, they happen to be photos that Bill took. He's an amazingly good photographer, and they resonate. But they're used sparingly, and they're used mostly for pacing. We feel that the narrative itself casts a spell. That if you put a great story in the hands of a great writer, from that very first sentence, they are casting a spell, and they're bringing you in. And anything that interrupts that spell, that breaks that spell, is detrimental to the story. So providing off-ramps from that narrative in the form of video or audio or the typical things that you might see in an enriched ebook of the sort that, you know, our friends at Atavist do enriched ebooks, and they're really great, but they're very different types of stories.
John, as you were mentioning about the Japan thing, I thought about the cost of sending the writer or the journalist or the author there, and that brings up the question of, this is an expensive proposition that you're doing, it seems like, and so the funding that you're getting right now from, I guess, an investor, how do you sort of foresee that continuing forward?
The explosion in the market of ebooks is huge, and we think there's a really amazing business to be built around this particular segment. Great stories told primarily in digital form in this, you know, for a single sitting, and readable on whatever tablets and mechanisms they want. So we're quite confident that this is an amazingly good business. What we were lucky enough to do is begin talking to some angel investors that got very excited about the idea of focusing specifically on this space, on this underserved market. And, you know, and they believed in our vision, and we closed an angel round last week with some amazing strategic partners, some amazing angels. I think it's been reported, so you guys know we closed at just under $1 million, and what we're going to be able to do with that is make our technology a little bit more robust to make sure that all of the things that we're doing on the website is great for the reader, that we'll also be able to build out our editorial team and work with writers that we want to work with and get them on stories that are urgent and great and able to be told in this way. So it's just going to allow us to move a little more swiftly, develop some more stories. We've got 20 Byliner originals in the works already. We've got the full website that's launching in a couple of weeks, and I think users are going to be knocked out by it. There's nothing like it online.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, and good luck with the project.
Thank you for having me.
So the last thing we'll talk about is Apple, and it's caught up in kind of a bit of a tempest around its tracking and tracking people with the iPhone and iPads with this consolidated .db file. Now there's been an interview on All Things D where, you know, Steve Jobs and some executives have come out and said, you know, oh, it's all a big misunderstanding, you know, we're not tracking anyone, that's just part of our location services, and those locations are not that specific anyway, because it's really based on, I guess, the nearest cell tower. You know, do you think this is the kind of thing that just people care about for a week, and then the next week they just go on and use their iPads and iPhones, and no one really cares? And even now, it came out that Google has been tracking people on Android phones too. And I mean, we even talked about, you know, phones are all tracking everyone. So how much does it matter?
Right. Yeah, I think the question you had is actually the answer as well. Yeah, I don't think people care beyond a certain point, unless there is a sort of a big headline exemplary case that sort of highlights the negative of it. I think it's the Craigslist issue, which is that the Craigslist adult listings. Nobody cared until there were some headlines that grabbed everybody's attention, and there were genuine problems with it.
Right,
So, and
the
I think
Craigslist killer.
the Craigslist killer kind of headline. So there has to be a iPhone stalker, I don't know, some whatever name you want to come up with, examples, unfortunately, for it to register on public consciousness beyond a certain point.
Know, we're such a reactionary society. We don't really worry about, you know, the dangers until something really happens and someone falls over the cliff. Then we'll put up something there to make sure no one falls over.
Yeah, and then by definition, the overreacts, and that's what it is. So yeah, I think it's a 2 week, 2 3 week story unless something bigger happens.
Yeah, and we'll just go over the media shift had it. We ran a poll about it, and there were definitely mixed responses to it. We asked, you know, what you think about iPhones tracking your location. 32% said that they should let me opt out of it, which I believe you can in some way. You can. I mean, this is the thing that really is tricky, is that, yeah, you can opt out according to Apple by turning off your location service, but, you know, then that's going to mean what? You can't use mapping, you can't use a lot of the
That's true.
different apps, and so you're kind of caught in this quandary. And this goes for tracking online too. People can turn off cookies, you can turn off all these things, but then you're not going to get personalization. You're not going to have, you know, you're going to have to sign in at every site you ever go to.
Yeah, that's like half of the stuff on the web.
Right. So this idea that you can turn it off, it seems easy, but, you know, then you're going to lose out on a lot of what makes using your iPhone or your Android phone really great.
Yeah.
So 32% say they want to opt out. 23% say that it's seriously creepy and they should stop. And then 21% say it's not a big deal. So that's almost as many as the people who say it's creepy. So you've got about half and half kind of split on that. And then about 17% said that they need to be more transparent about it, which I think we all can agree on.
I think, I mean, the answer is yes, and yes.
All the above. It is
All of the above,
creepy, and
really.
it is creepy, but, you know, be transparent about it, and in a way, maybe it isn't a big deal yet until we find out who's doing what with the data. Thanks for tuning in for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer of PBS Media Shift, along with co-host Rafat Ali. Thanks to our special guest, John Taman, the CEO of Byliner. And special thanks to PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to check out all the stories, polls, and information over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister blog, Idea Lab, at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.
Time.